Welcome to the Time and Motion podcast with me, your host, Lee Stevens. For over 25 years, I've worked with businesses all over the world to improve the technology and the people within them. In this podcast, I share some of my experiences and I chat to guests who generously share their stories of how to, or in some cases, how not to, live a productive life. I hope you enjoy the show. Hi, and welcome to episode 5 of the Time and Motion podcast. This episode is the first of two parts where I catch up with speaking coach Michael Philpott. Michael coaches lots of famous politicians, business executives, and other prominent people across New Zealand how to speak better. One of the speakers he coached actually did one of the most viewed TED Talks of all time. Michael's got some amazing stories to tell, and I didn't think I'd be doing him justice cramming it all into an hourly slot like I usually do. So in part one, Michael talks about overcoming adversity despite having such a tough life. He was sent to an orphanage at the age of 5. He was also diagnosed later in life with ADHD and then battled addiction to Class A drugs. It's a tale of two parts, however, because in part two, Michael also talks about his career here in New Zealand. He talks about his involvement in TED Talks, and he talks about some of the people he's coached as a speaking coach. He also talks about how you can become a better speaker in all walks of life, and he talks about some of the common mistakes we all make when speaking. So I hope you enjoy part one. If you want to hear the rest of the story, remember to download episode 6, which is part 2 of Michael's story. On with the show. Michael Philpott, welcome to the show.
Thanks, man. It's good to be here.
Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you too.
Looking well?
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's the shirt, right?
Oh, I wouldn't expect anything less from you. So, Michael, really appreciate you coming on to the Time and Motion podcast. Episode number 5, I believe.
Yeah. Congratulations.
So, you're in really good company. Thank you. And really enjoyed doing the show so far, and just really enjoyed listening to people, hearing their stories, hearing about their life and how they can be productive, which is why the Time and Motion podcast exists. I've got to say, firstly, this is probably like a busman's holiday, as we used to say in England. So onto a podcast, inviting a speaking coach, it's only going downhill from here. Right? Let's be honest. And so I'm actually dreading the next 60 minutes in some ways as well. But
you'll be fine. You'll be great.
Okay, so Michael, before we get into you and what you do as a speaking coach, always like to go back a little bit and start off with the early years. So yeah, tell us about some of those early years for you. You know, where did you grow up?
So I grew up a mixed bag between Christchurch, Whanganui, and Auckland. I was actually born in Hokitika. Not many people know that, which gives me automatic rights to white baiting and six fingers.
So once again, we have got an international listenership. So explain Hokitika, what that's famous for.
Hokitika is famous for, well, art and all sorts, but mostly for being a great place to catch white bait, which is a very delicious meal that you have here in New Zealand, a white bait patty. But there are big people quite often fight over whose little plot of land is that you're on. So having been born there, it means that I can go back to the coast and safely catch white bait.
And gemstones, is that right? Is it the jade stones?
Yeah, so jade stones as well. Yep.
So people know it from that. Yep. And does the food and wine festival once a year?
Yeah, they do too. They do. So what's strange about Hokitika is I was born there and then taken straight from there, and for your international audience, this is going to get even harder, taken straight from Hokitika to Karamea. So Karamea, for anyone that doesn't know, is kind of like at the top far end of the South Island on the east coast, and it's a dead-end town. Like, literally, it's a dead-end. You drive to it, and there is no connection to the rest of the island. You have to drive back. And there's a track that goes through there, which is called the Hefi track. And it's a 77K walk to get to essentially the other side of the mountains and, end up somewhere around Nelson. So I went straight from Hokitika to Karamea, where I was, I grew up until I was 9. And then my father took me to Whanganui and I grew up there.
What was the reason for moving around so much?
Well, you know how parents can be. So my parents split up. They split up. My mother stayed in Karamea for a little bit and then she went back to Christchurch. I think she was originally from Christchurch. She was qualified draftsperson. Yeah. And ended up living in the middle of nowhere in the Wop-Wops and the Boonies with my father. I was the youngest of three and he just went, right, I'm out. And he took me to the north when they split up.
Okay. What was your family like growing up?
Different. Well, everyone says normal, right? So I'll go the opposite. Oh, my upbringing was normal. Different. So my upbringing was a little bit dynamic that I ended up in an orphanage, right? So I think I was 5 years old. I was put into an orphanage with my brother and sister. I was there for a year. They were there for a couple of years. So that had a kind of huge impact. I don't remember anything prior to that in my childhood and don't remember much in between either. But I grew up with, you know, two separated parents, one in the north, one in the south. So you end up with kind of almost you become two different people a little bit, you know. You got the person you are around your dad, and then you got the person you are when you're around your mum. And we spent most of our time growing up with our mother in Christchurch. To add to that, a bit of interesting insights. My mother was gay, and so I grew up in a gay household. And this is around the 80s, right? So I think it was only made legal in 1982 or something like that. So growing up in that kind of environment was, very insightful, very different. A lot of growth for a younger person. But polar opposites, my mother and father. So my father was all, you know, masculine, manly, truck driving type of stuff. And then, you know, growing up in a gay household in the South Island. So definitely two different things as I grew up, which I think probably growing up splits you into two, if not more than that. And then the whole rest of your life as growing into an adult is bringing those parts back together.
How did you end up in the orphanage?
Yeah, so I'd like the answer to that one myself. I came down from the North Island, actually, because I was living with my father until I was five, and I came down for the first time for a holiday to see my brother and sister. And, you know, as a five-year-old kid, must have thought it was spectacular because I didn't grow up with many other children at all, and had a good time with them and, from all accounts, wanted to stay but didn't understand what that would mean to stay. I've just been looking through my records recently, and pretty much I would have been down for the Christmas school holidays, and I was put into the orphanage on the 2nd of February. So at the end of the school holidays, I went straight from having a lot of fun into an orphanage that is now part of the New Zealand Royal Inquiry into abuse and care. So, yeah.
Okay. There we go. That's one of the tricks of being a speaking coach. You have alarms and timers for everything.
those are actually my ADHD alarms. And we can talk about that too if you want. Yeah.
Okay, so I don't want to dwell on what's obviously a quite an emotional subject, but how long was you in the orphanage for, and then when did you move out of the orphanage, and what did life look like after that?
So I was there for a year, the emotional part's been separated. You know, it's I'm quite okay with it now. There for a year, and then from there out into Christchurch, and you know, schools, local schools, stayed relatively local, but struggled at school a lot. So I left school when I was 14 and a half. I actually started taking Fridays off school. By then I'd moved to the North Island, back to Whanganui, and I was living with my father. And I'd take Fridays off school at 13 years old, and I used to work in an aluminium window construction factory. And we got to 14 years old, 14 and a half, and I had to get special permission to leave from the school board for New Zealand. And I did. And my first job at 14 and a half was working in a dog roll making factory, which back then was called Tendicus Meats. And that's kind of where it started. So, yeah, my career working started at 14 and a half.
Why was that?
Education was tough, right, for me. It was really hard. That as well, my father being a he was educated, but he was always the type of person that was more like, you know, hard work, you know, as opposed to my mother, who was a, you know, qualified draftsperson. So he had no qualms with sort of understanding that, you know, getting away from school and just getting physical and earning money through working hard, you know. Yeah, that was pretty much why.
And was it just because you wasn't academic, or was it because you mentioned the ADHD, mm-hmm. and we're talking, what, 20, 30 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. So, and probably wasn't a thing then. It wasn't most people weren't diagnosed, and it was just, yeah. You would have been the naughty kid, the disruptive kid a lot of the time in those circumstances. So was it a case of you, at the time, obviously looking back, that you was probably struggling with ADHD and all the other stuff that goes with that, mm-hmm. as well as possibly not being academic as well, right? Which not all of us are. Mm-hmm. So what would you say to that?
So definitely. I was diagnosed at 43 years old, 43 or 44 years old, right? And it was funny because I went and spoke to my doctor, because my wife was like, you're becoming a bit of a weirdo. We need to go and see the doctor. So we went and see my doctor, sat down and explained all of the stuff. And I jokingly said to my doctor, I'm like, I think I just need to be legally microdosed, you know? And she just cracked up laughing at me. She was like, come on, I've known you all your life. I bet that it's undiagnosed adult ADHD. And I'm like, no way. Like, I'm not ADHD. So we went through a list of stuff. She pulled up a list, and my wife's sitting there going, yep, yep.
So what yep. are those things? Because I was doing my research this morning. I was like, I think I might be ADHD. So just explain for the listeners out there, you know, because you're not the first person I've heard that has been diagnosed with ADHD in adulthood, right? Mm-hmm. So what are the kind of common themes, characteristics that you should be looking out for there?
So as an adult, essentially, if I boil it down to its most basic, right, so ADHD is a dopamine deficiency in the brain, which means that when people like myself do things, and there are, like, think of a spectrum, right, and the spectrum is quite really wide. I fit within a certain part of that spectrum, which means that my behaviors are very specific to me, and your common traits might not be the same as what someone else might have, but there are some things that are very similar. Mine would be that when I achieve amazing, incredible things, my brain doesn't fire dopamine. Right. So your normal reward system that a person would get would be like, you know, wow, you've achieved these great things. Me, I just go, cool, and move on. Cool, and move on. And I'm always, what's the next thing? What's the next thing? What's the next thing? But it's not driven by dopamine. It's driven by something else. For me at school, to go back to the school kind of example, I was exceptionally good at woodwork, metalwork, craft, anything that required hands-on, where I could visually see what needed to be done, and then I could just recreate it through the use of my hands. Anything that took cognitive process was like algebra, you know, like reading, writing, spelling, algebra. It was all algebra to me. But what was really difficult was you would look around and you'd see other people who would just be doing this stuff with ease. And you're just sitting there going, I have no idea. And you, from a kid, you grow up with this frustration that you just seem to be the person in the room that cannot do what everyone else is doing so easily. There are many, many multitudes of other parts to it. I spend a lot of time in my head. My ideas are rampant and fast. However, now I've turned that into what I actually use to be so good at what I do with my work.
And that, now it's been diagnosed, what do you do differently? Is it medication? Is it exercise? Is it you know, mental training? What do you do to because I don't want to say function, but you know, you obviously now it's the thing. So yeah, so what do you do differently?
So to function would be right, 100% spot on. I am on medication. It's taken 3 years to find the right one, and it turns out that I needed a stimulant and the focus part as well. Previously, I had the focus but not the stimulant, and it just didn't work, right? So I found other ways. I do like a gin, but I was liking them a bit too much to compensate for the lack of stimulant and the lack of dopamine. So they've got the medication right now, which is really important. But what it changes is that I can single things out, focus on them, and dedicate my time to it. Exercise has always been part of my life. Growing up, I went into outdoor guiding naturally, which helped with a lot of the other stuff where I was not as academically inclined at the time. Then the outdoor guiding kind of helped with that because it was all physical. Now, yes, definitely. I guess the irony of it, right, is that when you have ADHD, routine seems boring. You know, like having a routine. Oh my God, only boring people do that. I would never want to have a routine. I would never want to have stability. I would never want to have those types of things that other people around me have. And then when you find out you've got ADHD and you get diagnosed, then you go, you know what I need? Stability and structure. Yeah. And maybe that comes with age as well. But those are the key things that have helped me. Over and above that, I have an EA, you know, an executive assistant that takes care of a lot of the stuff that, for me, like, you know, just dealing with emails, booking dates for people, those types of things. I'm so what's the next thing that I could be having a conversation with someone on the phone and they're like, yeah, book me in for Tuesday. I'm like, yeah. And then I look to the side, see something else, and it's gone. So I have Natalie who helps with everything like that. And one of the key things that I've done is I've actually removed my phone number. So generally, you know, you can't find my phone number anywhere. And I've just funneled it so that any type of contact with me basically directs a person straight to Natalie. Natalie then filters that depending on, you know, what that person needs or wants, and then can direct it to me. So it means that I don't get kind of I don't get sideswiped by anything in the moment, and I can really focus on what I'm doing.
What you've described for me actually sounds you're describing most entrepreneurs.
Uh-huh.
And I'm gonna have a wild guess at this, that there's a lot, I know for a fact there's a lot of entrepreneurs out there and people that have started businesses that are dyslexic. Mm-hmm. And the reasons they're successful is obviously they're over communicators because they've had to. They explain things really clearly verbally because that's what they've had to do all their life. And what you're describing now, I would suspect that ADHD, and we're getting better at this diagnosing and getting to the root of a lot of these things. But I think, you're describing most of the entrepreneurs I know. And, yep. And I would say they've probably got even milder forms of ADHD. And it's just shiny, right? Oh, look, there's a new thing over there. Yep. And I think I'm definitely going to have to go back and look at the list myself now. So see if I fit on that list. Okay, so you've entered adulthood, and mm-hmm. you talked about some of those, one of those early jobs you had. So you had the sausage meat factory.
Yep,
and then what was the jobs after that?
The jobs after that, oh man, they were varied, but they were all tactile, hands on, right? So I was a builder's labourer for a few years. I got into shearing. I was also really good at tree surgery, so climbing up trees and cutting them from the top down to the ground. I loved that work. Anything dangerous, which is, again, ADHD, and then anything physical. So from there, I ended up I did a course in outdoor education, and part of that course was you got a taste test of all these different things, and I fell in love with rock climbing and abseiling. So I went on to become a qualified outdoor instructor specializing in rock climbing and abseiling. From there into corporate training, which was kind of a really big leap. So in the background through all of this learning stuff, right, and maybe this is partially overcoming ADHD as well, is I found something I really loved. And part of loving that meant that I had to study some things. Now, I sucked at doing it and I didn't like it, but I managed to scrape through on a lot of those things. So I had to do FEC, pre-hospital emergency care, with HeliVac. I had to do NLP, so neuro-linguistic programming, at least at a practitioner's level. And then we also got trained in accelerated adult brain-based learning, how the brain receives, processes, stores, and recalls information. So all of this really high-level thinking stuff. But what was happening is I was in love with what I was doing, and I could actually take – what I was learning and apply it directly to what I was doing. So it gave me a situational context for the information I was using, which then led to, like I say, I went from this outdoor guide. I think we were some of the most qualified outdoor instructors in the world. And, you know, we were trained by Dr. Rich Allen, and the NLP was with Dr. Richard Bolstead. And I ended up getting dragged into a corporate environment. So I had, back in the day, I had dreadlocks and facial piercings and tattoos.
I couldn't believe that. I saw that. I was doing my research. I was like, no way.
Yeah, I know, right?
This man's never had dreadlocks in his life.
So I went from that, and someone I met was like, you'd be perfect for our clients. And I was like, okay, that's interesting. So haircut, you know, remove some of the piercings and stuff, and put on a suit instead of shorts and stuff. And I ended up in the 26th floor of the Vodafone building in downtown Wellington, and training FMG, New Zealand Police, IRD, New Zealand Fire, Signa Insurance. And I was teaching them high performance coaching. So,
and but how do you get, because a reason I'm asking this question is that this is now probably about the fourth or fifth interview, and it's like, oh, yeah, I was doing this, and then literally fast forward, and then now I'm, you know, I'm working in the corporate world and world domination. And it's amazing how many people just, in their mind, that's the way it seems. It feels like it's probably happened in minutes, right? Mm-hmm. But how do you get from that to that, though? Because there's a bit in between where you don't just wake up one day and say, right, okay, I'm going to go and train FMG and Vodafone and all the big companies in New Zealand. So yes, what was the kind of the micro steps for you to get to that point? You must have been doing something that hit a nerve or was different, right?
Yeah. So what it was, the reason that I stood out to this person was because the combination of NLP and accelerated brain-based learning. So I'd been applying this in a context of a one-day personal development program with the American ambassadors, people-to-people who were coming over from the US. So all that was happening is we didn't realize at the time how good we were at what we did and how specialized in our field we were. So what happened is they brought me in and they were showing me through this model that they were using for high-performance coaching. And it's a model that still exists today. And I looked at their model, and it, from my perspective, it just felt clunky, you know? It was like, that's not how people have a real conversation. I said, look, think about it this way. You've got a person, you know, two mates, haven't seen each other in a couple of years, and they get in a car together and they decide to drive to Queenstown, right? You don't go through a model going, so over the last 2 weeks, tell me, what are the things that have been going good for you? You don't do that. You just go, so what's up? What have you been up to? You know, because poor you, it's 8-hour trip and the radio just broke and you've got to talk to each other. It's like, what have you been up to, man? And you're really excited. You're enthusiastic. And that's how the process should work. So I spoke them through it and they were like, oh my, we've been doing it wrong the whole time. Would you redevelop it for us? And I was like, sure. So I ended up essentially delivering the training, which I reconstructed. And then I just used my outdoor guiding tools to then cross it over into what would apply. Now, what made the most amount of sense was, especially for outfits like New Zealand Fire and New Zealand Police. So they were used to having management trainers come in, and management trainers would talk about, you know, coaching people through a process. Okay, so we have to let them make mistakes and then we can coach them. So you can imagine the police and New Zealand Fire's response to that, right? It's like, yeah, you need to leave. You have no idea, you know, what's at risk here. And then I come in and I've been hanging American students off a 200-foot cliff by a rope not much bigger than a shoelace. And I understand real risk versus perceived risk. And they just go, yeah, you get it. And I'm like, yeah, I get it.
So once again, I've learned a few things doing the early podcasts, and a couple of people, my wife included, said, make sure that your guests explain to the layman what these things are, because we're not all techies like you. We don't understand that jargon. So NLP, for anyone that's out there that maybe doesn't know what NLP is, just in 30 seconds, explain what it is and why it's so unique and different.
So I'll say, well, it's not for a start. So it's not natural language process for you tech people out there. It's neuro-linguistic programming. Fastest way is it's the study of excellence. So at a micro level, how do people get the results they do? And then a whole bunch of people went, wow, if we study like right down to their thought pattern and process, how they did it, what they say to themselves, how they move, everything about them. We can actually replicate that, and by replicating it, we can get the same results.
And so it's also been used in psychological terms in the last 10, 15 years as well, right? It's about reprogramming the brain to think differently and to deal with trauma and that kind of stuff. So it's used for different purposes.
100%.
So putting it in combination with your real world risk analysis and your day-to-day life and living the life that you did, I would understand that's probably quite a compelling proposition for businesses that probably aren't used to that variety in the background, right? Because it would have been stiff, I'm guessing.
For sure. Well, it was the disconnect. You know, it's like you don't get it. You don't understand. And that management trainer just goes back and looks at a book that they've been given because they're training for a company, right? Whereas me doing it myself, I had that real world background of real risk, which gave it real application.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things I take umbrage with in the corporate world is that often it's, I call it the gray suit, gray hair, gray mentality. I mean, obviously I'm just a bit jealous because I've got no hair, but the gray suit, gray mentality. It's often those big four, the accountant types who are dishing out this advice. They've never run a business in their life. They've never taken a risk in their life. They've learned it in a book, maybe went to a decent school, whatever. And then they're out in the real world. So, and it's like textbook kind of coaching, right? Rather than real world coaching. So I can understand why you would have been in demand. Okay, so you're now in the corporate world and you're earning a living doing NLP and that kind of stuff. So tell us about how the speaking stuff came about. Was that just a natural progression, or was it something you woke up one day and said, you know what, I'm going to learn how to talk and to give presentations? Tell us how that, you know, because once again, it's not something you just wake up one day and say, that's what I'm doing. Something, there must have been a trigger moment, was there?
Yeah, there was actually. So through, like, looking back at myself, chalk and cheese, right? I wouldn't even recognize myself as maybe at 14 years old, I would never have been able to explain my thoughts and feelings at all. I would have struggled a lot. So looking back at it, it's like to become what I have become, it's the polar opposite of what I would have ever thought I would end up doing. But I do remember the moment where I made the decisive decision to make speaking part of my career. And it was standing on a cliff overlooking a 200-foot drop off the side, you know, working with those American students. And I looked down at the ground, as I did most days, and a guide or an instructor, they have a safety line, which is attached to a steel cable. Now, our safety line is a lot thinner than the line that the actual students are going down. So if theirs is thin, ours is tiny. And it doesn't need to be strong. You know, it's a really dynamic piece of rope. But I looked at my little safety line and I looked over the cliff and I went, you know what? I wonder what would happen in my life if I fell off here. You know, my safety line broke or something went wrong. And I fell down there and I lived. See, I've spent all my life using my hands and my body to make money physically through hard work, you know. But what if I couldn't do that anymore? What would I do? And that's where it came about. So from there, I actually went back to school and I went to the University of Canterbury Adult Education and I did my adult learning certification. But from that moment is that decisive moment of looking over the edge and just going, yeah, I can't rely on my physical body for the entire rest of my life. But if I could speak well, then I could do that from any sort of platform.
And was it a particular – I'm trying to think how to answer this question. So the fact that you could speak well, you can apply that into lots of different industries. But was there a hero at the time, I guess, or someone who you was looking up to and going, do you know what? I want to be like him or her.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. It'd have to be Dr. Rich Allen, 100% Dr. Rich Allen. So I'd been introduced to him in that outdoor guiding world, right? So because we were dealing with with American ambassador students, he came over from the US and taught us how to speak to Americans, which is a totally different way than Kiwis speak at all, you know. We had to rethink our language. Stupid little things like, what's lino? Oh, well, that's linoleum. You know, take your rubbish and put it in the bin. And they're like, why would I put it in bin. I'm like, trash, put it in the trash. He basically taught us how to reprocess how we spoke about things, right? But he's this giant 6 foot something American booming loud voice. And I just looked at him and went, yep, that's what I want. I want to be able to do that. And especially for the fact that he traveled the world, right? Like, he came over at that time from Texas. I was just like, us Kiwis looking at him going, well, this is just crazy.
He's the Messiah.
Yeah.
It's funny about those intricate nuances in the language, because I remember when I first came over about 9 years ago from the UK. So there was an Aussie lady I worked with. And so I was just being me, and I'd just be lean East End boy, and I'd be like, oh, you're all right, Vanessa, how's it going? Okay, yeah. And then next day, you're all right, how's it going? You're all right? And then it got about 3 weeks, 4 weeks in, I think. She was like, lady, she pulled me, can I have a word with you? So I, God, what have I done? She pulled me into the kitchen. She said, why do you keep asking if I'm all right? I've got nothing wrong medically. There's nothing wrong with my mental health. Why do you keep asking? I was like, it's a saying. It's like, like ça va, in French, or are you okay? Oh, I didn't realize. I thought you was actually genuine concern. And she was like, just because I was saying, it's just those little, that one word can be so different. But I get that completely.
It triggers, right?
Yeah.
So like your language process is triggering something because of their language process. So their interpretation of what you're saying is different. Yeah.
So you're on the journey to becoming speaker coach, and obviously it's a craft that you're applying your trade at. And so this was how long ago when you started that journey, Michael?
Well, that's a funny thing. I didn't start a journey to become a speaker coach. So I had this thing, right? I had this thing where when I first walked into the training corporate world, I was like, oh my God, look at this. This is so crazy. I've got this suit on and everyone's so, powerful and important. Here's me coming from the outdoor guiding world. And then I was put in a situation. I just did my thing and people seemed to enjoy it. The results were really good. But I still hadn't seen what it looked like when other people did it. And then I was at the EMA, so the Engineers and Manufacturers Association up in Auckland, right? And I'd been asked to do a public workshop, where they brought in a bunch of different people. And in the environment, there were different rooms and there were other people running training workshops. And this is my first time I got to see other training. And I had at lunchtime, I think it was lunchtime or morning tea, I had music cranking, the door was open and everyone was having a quick break. And then I had people walking into my room from other rooms going, can we come into your room? Like, can we come in just, I don't care what you're teaching, but can we come and hang out with you for the day? Cause it sounds like it's awesome. And I managed to sneak a peek through a window, glass window of someone else running training, and it was dark. The lights were off. There was a person in a very similar looking suit to the person in the next room, in the next room, in the next room. And they were standing at the front of the room with a PowerPoint that looked like death. And they were talking. And I remember seeing the look on the faces of the people in the room. They were all slung back in their chairs and they looked like they were dying. And from that moment, I went, I'm going to be the best trainer in New Zealand. That's my goal. Yeah. So I set out to do that.
And I think you've done that. But yeah, everyone I speak to has been through your stewardships. Got nothing but good things to say, right? So the other thing I just thought there, just listening to you speak, is it seems to be something in New Zealand that we don't embrace enough the difference. So, and I think anyone that's a little bit different and successful, we then have the tall poppy thing that comes in, right? We just cut them off at the knees and go, oh no, we don't like different. And why do you think that? I mean, like I said, hopefully I'm not overgeneralizing. This is home for me, and we're not going anywhere anytime soon. But why do you think that is that those differences and those people that do things a different way aren't as embraced and as put on a pedestal and given the acclaim that they would do if they was in the UK or the US?
Fear? I mean, if I was just straight to the point, right, it would be fear. I think there's a degree of, doing enough to do enough. And by highlighting people who are fantastic, it has a tendency to, kick back that maybe we could be better. So it's easier just to not highlight, and as opposed to other countries, yeah, for sure. You know, like celebrating someone's success, like really celebrating it, and means that you look at them with inspiration and aspiration that you want to be like that too. And it's something we definitely don't do here, but we need to do more of, and not just in the regular sports and stuff like that, but other industries and other areas where it's like to aspire to be better is what we all need to achieve. To do that, I've always looked offshore. You know, like my, you know, you asked before, who's my person? And it was Dr. Rich Allen. It's someone who's international, because at that time there would have been no one in New Zealand who I would have seen, who I would have aspired to be like. And there are a few more popping up now, and definitely to celebrate them. But tall poppy syndrome is alive and well in New Zealand. It's funny, I've never been cut down, because I do hear a lot of it and I do see a bit of it, but I've never had it myself. And I'm grateful for that. There must be something about what I do or the way that I do it that doesn't draw that to me. But yeah, I've not personally experienced it, but I know that a lot of people have.
Yeah, I think a lot of the time it's an attempt to cut them down. It's just the little slide digs, you know, online. Yeah, and it's easier to do that with the current social media platforms that we have, right? So, yeah. And I think most people probably don't care, right? They just get on and do their thing these days. Okay, so you've progressed in your career. You're now doing speaker coaching. TEDx, tell me how that came about.
So I'm not doing speaker coaching at that time. I'm training. That's me. I'm hard out running training and development for years and years and years, right? That's my gig. TEDx then comes up, and like I hadn't even thought about coaching. I taught coaching. I trained coaching. I trained people how to be exceptional coaches, but I never thought about coaching myself. I preferred being, you know, let's be honest, the center of attention in the room, you know, come on everyone and using my tools to help them learn more. So yeah, coaching was never a concept for me, for myself, but then I got invited by a friend of mine to be the speaker coach for TEDx Christchurch. And it was like, yeah, sure. I mean, that sounds interesting. What is this TED stuff? So because I didn't even know about it at the time, right? So they brought me in and I did some coaching, met some wonderful people, just naturally did what I did. I just, you know, in my mind, that doesn't sound as good as it could, you know, or I just can't feel there's something missing with what you're trying to say, or there's a disconnect. So I just did that, and people got incredible results, and they were more comfortable and confident when they got on stage. So the first year was at the Isaac Theatre Royal where we delivered it, and it was to an audience of, I don't know, I think it was about 1,200 to 1,400 people. And my clients were like, I had a 12-year-old, with Tourette's, and her mum. And then I had, a whole bunch of other people in there as well. But I just, it appeared that I was good at it. And I didn't think much more of it than that. It was a volunteer role. Not many people know, you know, and we would take 6 months leading into a 1 day event. That's how much time we would invest into the creation of that 1 day event. But then I coached, my wife selected, Lilia Tawara, so the granddaughter of the founder of Gloryvale, which is a religious cult on the west coast of the South Island of New Zealand. So my wife selected Lilia, and I coached her. And it was a time Lilia had just written a book, which was, I think it was Daughter of Gloryvale. And it was getting a lot of attention, and we were like, yeah, that'll be perfect, actually. We'll get her to come and talk. And I spoke to Lilia. And I said, what are you going to talk about? She was like, oh, this will be easy. I'll just take a piece out of my book and, you know, just kind of, you know, not read it, but I'll share that piece. And I'm like, yeah, how about we don't do that? I was like, if they can read the book themselves, well, why speak about it on stage? How about we do something different? Why don't we talk about what you couldn't write in the book? Because it was too emotionally challenging for you. And she was like, really? I'm like, yeah. Let's do that. And I said, what's your target? You know, where do you want to end up with this talk? And she was like, I want 3 million views on YouTube at least. And my mouth dropped open a little bit. My heart, you know, kind of beat a little bit harder. And I was like, okay, cool. Then we definitely need to do something really different, right? So we took 10 weeks, which is a very short period of time for a lead into a TEDx talk or a TED talk. We took 10 weeks and we were working like at least 2 to 3 times together a week for a couple of hours at a time, and we crafted her talk, which has now become the most viewed TEDx talk in New Zealand, the fifth most viewed on the planet. It's been uploaded to the official TED, transcribed into six languages, and has been viewed over 12 and a half million times. So that happened, right? And it took a little while, not, you know, for that to happen. It definitely took off quick. But I was talking about some stuff with another person around business, and they were like, after what you did with Lilia, why are you not actually coaching, you know, for real? And I'm like, yeah, okay, maybe it's worth considering. And I ended up, Jade Software Corporation reached out to TEDx Christchurch, to Kyla Colburn, and said, hey, who would you recommend as a speaker coach? We've got one of our people who definitely needs some help. And she went, well, Michael, of course. So that was it. I became officially a paid speaker coach.
And what year are we talking here, Michael?
Oh, we're talking to 2017, maybe, somewhere around there.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe 2016, 2017.
Six, 7 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's interesting in the other organisers, because in my professional life, I've come across, I think, most of them who I didn't really put two and two together to actually realise you all knew each other. So Ian and Sutter and yourself and Kyla and others, right? So was Kylie involved? Kylie Richardson?
I can't remember. Maybe.
No. Yeah. Okay. And in terms of the selection process, so how involved was you in terms of the TED people come along and saying, this is what we're looking for? Because from my understanding, speaking to others, they've got a very set way that they select their people, and they've got a very set way and set of expectations that they have for how people speak when they give their talks. It has to be certain time frames and delivery style, etc. Yeah. So just how much do you know about that?
All of it. So I was on the speaker selection committee. So there's four people, but I was also part of the bigger committee as well, and the speaker coach. So very involved, and very invested. Funny question around that, you know, is how do people get on the stage? So I've helped a couple of people since we stopped running TEDx Christchurch. I've helped a couple of people get on the stage in other parts of New Zealand. And the answer to the question is pretty simple. What is the process? At the start of the year, the committee will generally come up with a theme for the year, and that theme will then dictate the speakers that get searched for. Within those four people in the speaker selection committee, there will be kind of people that spring to mind for that specific theme, and they will be reached out to. So, you know, we bought Hamish Brewer in from from the US. We bought free diving champion William Truebridge in, you know, from, he brought him in from the islands and stuff like that. So depending on the content that we were looking for and how it aligned to what we were doing. And outside of that, it would be people would apply as well, put their applications through, and we would consider those as well. But generally the misfire was where if it wouldn't be aligned to our actual thing that we'd pre-done. And of course, people, we didn't advertise that because we didn't want people coming to us going, I have this perfect talk for you. We don't want them to make the talk for our theme. We want to find people that live our theme, and we can then take that and make it bigger and stronger and more powerful, you know, and share that message in a way. So the structure around it is, you know, averaging TED Talks that, you know, they max out at 18 minutes. I've only ever seen a couple go over, and that would be Anthony Robbins, Tony Robbins. He spoke for like 19 or something minutes, and he was just like, am I okay to keep going? And they're like, yeah, keep going, because it was just so awesome. But generally it's a strict adherence to 18 minutes. As far as the format for it and how it works, is it's word perfect, word for word. For us, you know, I would, you know, as the coach, I would meet a person, I would get an idea of where they're at, what they wanted to do, the time frame they were given. So the time frame slot would be based on their subject and the structure of the day as well. So some people might get a 5-minute slot depending on what they're talking about. Others might get a 12-minute, 14-minute. Lilia got an 18-minute because of, you know, the nature of what she was talking about. Also, we have to structure the day in an emotional sense as well. So we can't put a comedian just before, you know, some
heartbreaking moment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we can't put it after as well. You know, you can't, you know, because it's, you know, potentially disrespectful and the audience might take it the wrong way. But also we need to float the audience's emotions through things, like gradually lift and drop them. So we structure the day for that with where we place speakers. on top of that, the actual preparation into it is just what's your skeleton, you know, what are you actually talking about? What is your one key thing that you're trying to share? And I think that's with any speaking, people get a little bit lost in trying to have too many things that they want to talk about in any given period of time. So they overload it and they overload the audience. So what is your one idea? And then what is the body of information around it that helps people understand what that idea is, whether that's through stories or examples or metaphors or analogies, whatever helps that. And then, of course, if they're using a slide deck, what is the visual imagery that helps to reinforce that? So if you catch Lilia Tower's talk, you'll notice that it's just all heavy image based and that images are specifically made to evoke emotion with the talk. And that, yeah, so for each speaker, that's what we do. And they would have, you know, a lot of time with me, and then we'll put them in front of the speaker selection committee, at least a couple of weeks out, before they have to actually deliver it, to test it on a live audience and make any final tweaks, but also check their nerves to make sure they're good. And then, yeah, we have a dress rehearsal on the day before, go through the whole stage process under the big lights. For a lot of people that haven't been on those big stages, the blinding glare of being under stage lights, having to just get used to that, putting them on a, you know, the majority would be on a headset mic, which they've never experienced before, which is kind of weird. And
turn into Madonna, right?
Yeah, pretty much, right? Yeah. Bit of Britney Spears going on. So just getting used to tech and getting used to the experience, figuring out. I mean, I dig down right down to like, what are you going to wear? What are you going to wear on the day? And they're like, oh, I didn't even think about that. It's like, you might want to. A couple of reasons you might want to is, one, you want to practice in those clothes, and you definitely don't want to go out and buy brand new clothes for this big, cool experience and then find out on the day that it's a bit uncomfortable, you know, like it rides in places I don't want it to. So you want to be comfortable in your clothing and stuff. Outside of that, yeah, just getting people as comfortable and confident as they can, you know. And I think about speakers that I've worked with who are a little bit more like me. You know, I've had speakers where I've had an 18-minute slot and it's just like, they've got it word perfect. And this is second go at it. You know, they retain information really well. But at the other end of the spectrum, I've had people who are more like me who are like, the more I try and push that information into my brain, the harder it is to find.
I'd be in that category, I think.
Yeah, right. So it's like the more pressure, the harder it is to actually remember. So in some situations, I've definitely had to make changes to the format to accommodate for that, because there's no way I'm going to put anyone on stage knowing that it could be negative outcome for them. And we've never had anyone freeze on stage while I've been involved in it, or had in cases. There are some cases where I set up a you've got a confidence monitor. So most people in, you know, the US or other parts of the world understand confidence monitor, but New Zealand, we probably refer to it as a slide deck screen where you get to see your PowerPoint coming up next. For one of my speakers, they didn't have a PowerPoint at all. And on the day of delivery, they came to me and just went, I can't, like, I'm freaking out. Like, you know, I'm used to people freaking out, but this was different freaking out. This was, I cannot remember what I need to say, and I'm scared. And I'm just like, okay, you don't have a slide deck. What can we do? And it's like, can we get your notes on the confidence monitor? And I talked to the tech guys and they were like, yep. I was like, cool. How does it work though? Because the clicker won't work and stuff like that. And it was like, can you listen to the person speaking and then just scroll with them? And they were like, let me check. Yeah, we can. I'm like, done. And we just resolved it, right? So the confidence monitor turned into a script. But the cool part being is, once the person knew that it was there, they didn't even look at it very much. They just had the confidence that if they got lost, it was there. here are other sneaky little things. Like I was once on the side of the stage doing, you know, line, line, give me the line. And, it was for a very famous person. And, I remember, it was at the, towards the end of the day and my phone, I was looking at it, had this script on it. And my job was to be on the sideline line. And I'll just go, you know, say a couple of words that lead into the next line. And my phone battery starts flashing. It's like flashing, like your phone's going to die. And I'm like, oh, what's going to happen if my phone literally dies? And this person goes, line, what am I going to do? And it had me sweating. And I don't even remember the, you know, that part of the whole day because it was just so terrifying for me. But we got through it.
Yep.
And then, of course, good editing went a long way. But yeah, no, TED's a huge process, right? It's like getting people to speak at an international level. And I think that's what really separates, you know, why are those talks so good? Any that I had anything to do with, it's coming at it from that real international level. And I think that's the part where I want to see more of in New Zealand for our speakers.
And TED's still going on?
Not for Christchurch. So we got to, I was part of it for 4 or 5 years and probably 4 years I was part of it. And they were the final 4 years. So basically, the team, Kyla, got to 10 years. They did a massive, massive event. And at the end of those events, right, I remember walking down the street and seeing one of my colleagues and I hadn't seen them since TED. And I was walking down the street, ran into them and they hugged me and started crying. Like just broke down in tears, because it was such a huge, huge part of life and it took so much energy. So with all of that energy, it's kind of like that thing where it's like, finally we're done. It's a big celebration and then it all kind of calms down and you remember how much energy and effort you put into it, unpaid. And then the team kind of gathers back together and goes, what are we going to do next year? And it's like, do you go bigger? You know, like, or do you go smaller or do you like go, have we done enough? And, you know, we did that year on year, big and then a bit smaller and then big again and, you know, exhausted and then not so exhausted. And at the end of the 10 years, I wasn't there for that last one. Basically it was right. They did like 2,500 at the, in the center of Canterbury, Christchurch here. At the town hall, 2,500 people or more, and they had all their speakers, but that was pretty much the 10 years is enough. Let's end on a high note. Yeah. But throughout New Zealand, there are still other, outfits that are doing and running, TEDx in New Zealand.
What's your favorite TED talk of all time?
Favorite TED talk is pretty easy. It's, pediatrician Nadine Burke-Harris. And it's not a TED talk. It's not a TEDx talk. It's a TED-Med talk. Nadine Burke-Harris talks about how childhood trauma impacts health across a lifetime. It's just incredible, like perfect, beautiful, emotional. And it's to an audience of, you know, medical specialists and very passionate. I would recommend everyone check it out.
Yeah, mine's the Philip Stark one where he talks about evolution. Have you ever seen this one? So he's the famous French designer and a lady who was quite influential in my early career put me onto it. And it's essentially where what he's saying is when we was evolving as humans, our peripheral view was always down. Mm-hmm. And then as we evolved, our periphery started going up. And obviously as we become the humans that we are now, we had reason why we was more successful was as predators because we had that peripheral view. And he was saying there was a metaphor there in terms of business in the fact that if you're constantly looking down or looking, if you're not looking at the bigger picture,
yeah,
you don't have that peripheral view. And so it's things like that you remember, right?
And
that was probably one of my favorite. Are you all right for time, by the way?
Yeah, I'm good. Okay. I'll have to check out that talk. It sounds really cool.
Yeah.
From an NLP perspective, that is.
It's amazing. There's that one. And there's a few ones that kind of, that you remember. And there's a famous Ken, someone, I want to say Ken Robinson, but, forgive me if that isn't the name, but he's a famous, ran a famous design agency and he was talking about the education system in the UK
yep.
and how it was targeted academia, and actually there's all these fantastically talented people that are getting failed by the system, right? And it probably resonates with yourself.
It is Ken Robinson.
It is Ken Robinson, yeah.
Yeah. So that kind of, that is exactly where it leads to. So what I found over time was that, you know, with the pitching and presenting and the coaching stuff that I've been doing, I started to notice something. And I actually came to this conclusion when I was at Dr. Rich Allen's retirement party in Auckland, which was, wasn't that long ago. And I was talking to him and I said, I just realized that you didn't teach us just about, you know, adult, you know, accelerated adult learning. You taught me how to be the, to find the point in between neurodiverse. So you've got neurodiverse, ADHD and spectrum at one end, and then you've got neurotypical at the other end. What you taught me was how to actually bring neurodiverse closer into the middle. So neurodiverse would be me, right? Like if I'm not careful and don't structure myself well, then I follow, like my brain is like a dog chasing rabbits, right? It's like, oh, let's look at so much stuff to talk about, and it just goes rampant and nuts. So I bring in a bit of structure, but keep the energy of ADHD or, you know, neurodiverse. And then I take the other end of the spectrum, which is neurotypical, which is, you know, slow to bring about the ideas and maybe a little bit lower in energy, but very specific. I bring those two things together and you've got neuro-inclusive communication. And I said to him, that's what you actually taught us. You were teaching us how to create neuro-inclusive presenters and trainers, which is such an incredible way of kind of understanding what it is that we're doing. We're trying to get people to speak and construct content in a way that everyone in the room can understand. And that whole thing around academia is that we've got people teaching who are at the other end, super neurotypical, and the majority of their audience are going to be neurodiverse. And it's like, why is it so hard? It doesn't have to be hard. It's set up. It is set up in the negative for learners, which is why we need to, you know, this whole thing around, you know, a movement around understanding more about neurodiversity. I mean, we've got currently globally 15 to 20% of people are diagnosed as, you know, neurodiverse. And it's like we're at the very, very early stages of finding that out. And all it's going to tell us is that the model has to change. Our traditional teaching, especially maybe more around the higher learning, is going to have to change. The delivery style is going to have to change. The way people present that content is going to have to change. Otherwise, it's a waste of time.
It does make me laugh. You just listening to you speak there is the conspiracy theorists and on Twitter and those places, and they're blaming this on cough medicine at the moment. Have you heard this one?
No, I haven't.
So it's like, why is it that, you know, ADHD numbers have gone up and through the roof? It must be the cough syrup. Oh, really? Are you really saying that? But yeah, absolutely. Okay, really, really interesting hearing how you're absolutely right. I think that diversity is great because you're seeing people from all walks of life and different spectrums, using the pun, but you know, just come in and you can, if you can see someone you can resonate with, that's got to be good for the younger kids coming through and the younger generations. So you, one question I'm going to ask you there on the TEDx, and you mentioned about the coaching and you did to Jade, how did you know what you was doing was any good?
It's a good question. I mean, I was charging a lot, so you'd hope that it would be good. They came to me with a problem, right? So the problem was is that they had a speaker who was being sent around Australasia, you know, being paid a lot of money, and it was costing a lot of money because it wasn't in a role as a paid speaker, but turn up at conferences and speak for 18 minutes, and what's the outcome that you want? And the outcome for any speaker in an environment like that is Q&A. They want fully engaged Q&A because that shows that, one, the content resonated and people were listening, and two, that it made sense and they are wanting to find out more. But what was happening was during the Q&A, the MC would jump up on stage and go, fantastic, thank you, that was awesome, any questions? And then, as what happens often at conferences, crickets, cricket, 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 nothing, right? So that to me was the very specific outcome, was to change that, to go from zero to either more or overwhelming.
If it's who I think it was, I actually think I was at one of those sessions where it was crickets as well.
Yeah. I've written a case study on it, so it's very open, you know.
Yeah.
The part being there is that we changed that, and there were very specific ways to change it, and the subject matter itself was really difficult. So anytime it's a subject that the person who's delivering it is a subject matter expert, then you're going to have problems. And the reason being is it's the curse of knowledge, right? So it's like the bridge between what the audience knows and what the speaker knows is too big, and they haven't spoken in a way that lays a foundation path for the people to follow to end up at the place where they want them to be. They just dive pretty much straight into the nuts and bolts. So we fixed all of that stuff, but basically, how did we measure the outcome? How do you know what you're doing is right and it was good? It was because the MC got on stage at the end of us fixing it, which, by the way, took 65 hours of their time in the background, along with 5 hours, well, 6 hours of my time. So for an 18-minute talk preparation. The MC got on stage. Thanks for that. We had a special little trick at the end as well that we did, but thanks for that. Any questions? And after a long period of time, the MC then said, look, hey, we've run out of time for any more questions. You're more than welcome to speak to the speaker in the break. And when they went to get off stage, there was a line waiting to talk to them. So it's like, there you go. That's how you know, right? And for different people in different situations, outcomes will be different. But the outcome is always achieved.
Okay. We've talked about your success professionally at that time. Obviously, for the outside world, you're living your best life and doing all that fantastic stuff. But I read in a post about a month ago, 2 months ago, that you was actually having quite a lot of upheaval in your personal life at that
mm-hmm.
time
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and was addicted to Class A drugs.
Mm.
So what's going on there? So that's episode 5. I really enjoyed talking to Michael, so much so that the story continues. So if you want to hear part 2 of his story, head over to episode 6, which we've published on the same day, and you can hear even more about his fascinating story.